From the moment Donald Trump descended the golden escalator in Trump Tower to announce his presidential candidacy, America embarked on a journey unlike any in its history. A Very Stable Genius by Washington Post reporters Carol Leonig and Philip Rucker offers an unprecedented look inside a White House where chaos reigned and traditional guardrails of democracy were systematically dismantled. Drawing from hundreds of hours of interviews with more than 200 sources, the book chronicles how Trump's impulsive decision-making, disdain for expertise, and prioritization of personal loyalty over national interest reshaped American governance. The book became an instant number one New York Times bestseller, with celebrities like Stephen King calling it the most frightening political book I've read this year. Its meticulous reporting earned praise across the political spectrum for revealing how close America came to constitutional crisis as seasoned officials struggled to contain a president who viewed himself as above the law and institutions as tools for personal gain. The unprepared Trump administration began with a chaotic transition that prioritized loyalty and appearance over experience and expertise. Rather than using the Federal Transition Office, Trump conducted job interviews at his personal properties, Trump Tower, his Bedminster Golf Club, and Mar-a-Lago, turning government appointments into a spectacle resembling his reality TV show. As one senior advisor recalled, people filled in paperwork on the airplane on their way down to the inauguration. In hockey, you can lose a knee playing with a lot of inexperienced people. That's how this has felt. Trump's staffing decisions revealed his priorities. He offered Mike Pompeo the CIA directorship after a single interview, impressed by his West Point and Harvard Law credentials, despite Pompeo having previously warned that Trump would be an authoritarian president who ignored our Constitution. For key positions, Trump prioritized the look: generals for national security roles, attractive women for communications positions. When planning his inauguration, Trump discovered Rick Gates' involvement and erupted in anger, impulsively appointing his 26-year-old body man, Johnny McKenty, as executive director of the $107 million operation despite having zero relevant experience. Family appointments created particular complications. Ivanka and Jared were determined to join the West Wing despite concerns about nepotism and ethics. There's some things in life, when you shoot, you better kill. I knew that this was not a winning effort to stop the kids from coming, recalled one colleague. Even Trump had reservations, asking, why would you want to kill yourself and come to Washington, D.C. and get shot up by all these media killers? But he couldn't deny his children. Ivanka sought special treatment as a volunteer advisor to avoid government restrictions while maintaining her business interests, including the Trump International Hotel in Washington. The administration's earliest foreign policy crisis emerged when Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, secretly discussed sanctions with Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the transition. After Flynn lied about these conversations to Vice President Pence and others, Acting Attorney General Sally Yates warned the White House that Flynn was vulnerable to Russian blackmail. Rather than addressing this security threat, Trump seemed more concerned about Yates questioning his personnel choices than about Flynn's deception. Trump's first weeks in office were marked by chaos and self-inflicted crises. On January 27, 2017, Trump issued a hastily drafted travel ban barring citizens from seven majority Muslim countries from entering the U.S. Created secretly by Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller without legal review, the order sparked chaos at airports worldwide. Even Homeland Security Secretary Kelly wasn't briefed on the final version before implementation. White House staffers were shocked watching footage of dark-skinned people being rounded up in foreign airports on television screens throughout the building. One official compared it to running a meeting in a Buffalo Wild Wings, with confused staff wondering why this was happening. When Acting Attorney General Yates refused to defend the ban on constitutional grounds, Trump fired her. Meanwhile, Miller explained to French Ambassador Arad that disruption was intentional. This president is revolutionary, so he has to break China. If we follow normal procedures, we work into the hands of our enemies. By early February, news reports revealed Trump's contentious calls with foreign leaders, including a heated exchange with Australian Prime Minister Turnbull over a refugee agreement. This is the worst deal ever. And threats to deploy troops to Mexico to stop bad hombres. Trump was furious about these leaks, demanding his aides find the sources and suggesting reporters should be jailed. Trump's distrust of the intelligence community deepened when leaders briefed him about Russian election interference. Despite advisers' pleas to acknowledge the intelligence findings, Trump resisted, believing it would delegitimize his victory. Though he briefly conceded Russia's involvement at a January 11 press conference, he immediately regretted it, comparing intelligence agencies to Nazi Germany for leaking the Steele dossier containing salacious allegations about him. Communications challenges plagued the administration from the start. Trump was unhappy with Sean Spicer's performance as press secretary, mocking him behind his back. "Sean can't even complete a sentence. We've got a spokesperson who can't speak." When Michael Dupke interviewed for communications director, his meeting was interrupted by Trump spontaneously deciding to hold a press conference that very day. Within hours, Trump delivered a rambling 77-minute televised screed claiming his administration was running like a fine-tuned machine despite obvious dysfunction. On March 1, 2017, nearly 6 weeks into his presidency, Trump struggled to read aloud the Constitution during filming for an HBO documentary. Despite selecting Article 2, which addresses presidential power, Trump stumbled over the language, growing irritated and blaming the crew for distractions rather than acknowledging his difficulties. This symbolic moment foreshadowed his troubled relationship with constitutional constraints. The next day, Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation after failing to disclose campaign meetings with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Trump erupted in fury, believing Sessions had left him unprotected. The president ordered Don McGahn to stop the recusal, shouting so loudly that staff in the hallway could hear him. Despite Trump's public statement of total confidence in Sessions, the Attorney General followed Justice Department ethics rules and recused himself, explaining that most people don't know the rules. Trump's fury over Sessions' recusal was explosive. Aboard Air Force One returning from Virginia, he railed about Sessions being weak and horrible, saying he should never have appointed him. Some junior staffers put on headphones to block out Trump's yelling. Trump invoked Roy Cohn repeatedly, telling McGahn that Cohn would have told them all to go to hell. Despite his advisors explaining that the Attorney General serves the American people, not the president personally, Trump demanded Sessions be fired. "Where is my Bobby Kennedy? Where's my Eric Holder? Where's my Roy Cohn?" Trump bellowed, citing attorneys general who he believed had protected their presidents. When FBI Director James Comey confirmed in congressional testimony that the Bureau was investigating possible coordination between Russia and Trump's campaign, the president became increasingly desperate to clear his name. Over several days in March 2017, Trump directed various officials, McGahn, Coates, Pompeo, Rogers, and Comey himself, to publicly state he wasn't under investigation. When none complied with these inappropriate requests, Trump's fury escalated. On May 8th, Trump summoned McGahn to the Oval Office, where nearly a dozen aides had gathered. Sessions and Rosenstein joined them for lunch in McGahn's office, where Sessions agreed firing Comey would be legal, while Rosenstein surprisingly supported the idea. Despite Priebus's warning that this is the wrong way to handle the firing, Trump proceeded, sending his bodyguard Keith Schiller to deliver the termination letter, not realizing Comey was in Los Angeles. The day after Comey's firing, panic spread through FBI headquarters and the Justice Department. Trump met with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and Ambassador Kislyak in the Oval Office, boasting to them, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off." He also assured them, "I'm not under investigation." On May 16, 2017, Robert Mueller was secretly brought to the White House while Trump interviewed FBI director candidates. The 72-year-old former FBI director, with his chiseled jaw and silver hair, was a living legend in law enforcement. Princeton grad, Marine Corps platoon leader, and FBI director through 12 years of the war on terrorism. Though Mueller made clear he wasn't interested in returning to the FBI, Sessions had urged the meeting to help Trump understand the Bureau's importance and independence. The next day, while Trump was delivering a self-pitying commencement address at the Coast Guard Academy, Rosenstein appointed Mueller as special counsel to oversee the Russia investigation. When Sessions delivered this news to Trump in the Oval Office, the president slumped in his chair and exploded. "Oh my God, this is terrible! This is the end of my presidency! I'm fucked!" Trump turned his fury on Sessions. "It's your fucking fault! You're weak!" When Sessions offered to resign, Trump demanded he do so, leaving the attorney general fighting back tears. Trump was genuinely frightened by Mueller, a tenacious, unblemished antagonist whose reputation for being apolitical and above reproach made him a formidable adversary. Mueller had built his reputation over 2 decades prosecuting mob bosses and terrorists, becoming FBI director just days before 9/11. Known for his gruff demeanor, high standards, and early morning work ethic, Mueller inspired fierce loyalty despite his demanding nature. Unlike his predecessor, Louis Freeh, who titled his memoir, My FBI, Mueller saw himself as merely a temporary caretaker of the Bureau. Trump's desperate search for legal counsel revealed his insecurity as a client. Kozowitz and partner Mike Bowe attempted to recruit experienced scandal lawyers, but faced numerous rejections. John Dowd, a 76-year-old legal legend and former Marine who had led Justice Department organized crime prosecutions, offered to help pro bono. Despite being past his prime, Dowd knew the inner workings of the Justice Department and had valuable Washington contacts, making him a useful supporting player on Trump's hastily assembled legal team. True to form, Trump wanted to solve his problems through personal relationships, repeatedly instructing his lawyers to go see Mueller and explain how the investigation was impairing his ability to function as president. He even suggested using Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis's leverage, noting their shared Marine background might engender sympathy from Mueller. His lawyers firmly rejected these approaches as inappropriate and legally unsound. Trump was impatient to meet Vladimir Putin from the beginning, repeatedly asking during transition, "When can I meet with Putin?" despite advisors explaining the diplomatic impropriety of meeting before inauguration. When they finally met at the G20 summit in Hamburg, 168 days into his presidency, Trump went to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of their conversation, personally taking the interpreter's notes and forbidding discussion with other officials. At their first face-to-face meeting on July 7, 2017, Trump greeted Putin saying, "It's an honor," while Putin flattered him with, "Your Excellency." Though they discussed Russia's election interference, Trump quickly accepted Putin's denials, leaving Russians with the impression Trump wouldn't hold them accountable. Trump later shocked officials by taking the interpreter's notes and instructing them not to discuss the conversation, leaving intelligence agencies with no detailed record beyond Tillerson's media briefing. The only detail that emerged was Trump responding to Putin's denials with, "I believe you," infuriating former CIA director John Brennan. Trump's eagerness to connect with Putin continued at the G20 gala dinner, where he left his seat beside Japanese Prime Minister Abe to speak with Putin for an hour, accompanied only by a Kremlin interpreter. While many world leaders sought Trump's favor through flattery, Japan's Abe giving him an expensive gold club, Britain's May rushing to Washington, Trump remained fixated on Putin. Tillerson, who knew Putin well from his Exxon days, tried educating Trump about Putin's character, warning that Putin was playing a long game to destabilize Western alliances, and wakes up every morning asking, "Where is America having problems? Let's go there now and make it worse." After meeting Putin face-to-face in Hamburg on July 7, Trump declared himself the Russia expert, dismissing Tillerson's years of experience. I have had a 2-hour meeting with Putin. That's all I need to know. I've sized it all up. A year later, Trump met with Putin in Helsinki despite knowing U.S. investigators had built an airtight case proving Russian election interference. In their 2-hour private meeting with only interpreters present, Trump refused to confront Putin. At their joint news conference, Trump rejected U.S. intelligence conclusions, stating, "I don't see any reason why it would be Russia who interfered," instead taking Putin's denial at face value. This performance horrified Washington's national security establishment, with Senator McCain calling it one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. Inside the Pentagon's sacred tank conference room, Trump's advisors staged an intervention to preserve world order. Secretary Mattis, Gary Cohn, and Rex Tillerson organized a tutorial to address alarming gaps in Trump's understanding of history and global alliances. Using maps and dollar sign-filled charts, they attempted to explain why U.S. troops were deployed worldwide and how America's safety depended on trade deals and alliances. But Trump grew impatient with the schoolhouse atmosphere, interrupting repeatedly with complaints about NATO, South Korea, and Afghanistan. "We should make money off of everything," he insisted, treating international relations like real estate deals. The meeting quickly deteriorated as Trump dismissed their explanations, railed against the Iran nuclear deal, and called Afghanistan a loser war. The July 20, 2017 meeting in the tank turned catastrophic when Trump told military leaders, "I wouldn't go to war with you people. You're a bunch of dopes and babies." These words stunned everyone in the sacred Pentagon space. Some officers looked down at their papers, others considered walking out, all wondering how a commander-in-chief who had avoided Vietnam service through a bone spurs diagnosis could speak this way to decorated military leaders. While Mattis sat silent with his head bowed and Pence remained frozen like a statue, Tillerson finally erupted. "No, that's just wrong. Mr. President, you're totally wrong. The men and women who put on a uniform don't do it to become soldiers of fortune." After the meeting, a deflated Tillerson called Trump a fucking moron to a small group in the hallway. Military leaders were so shocked, they tried keeping the incident secret, with Dunford later misleadingly describing it as merely an energetic and interactive dialogue when asked publicly. During an April 2018 Situation Room meeting about Afghanistan troop deployments, Trump repeated his demand that countries pay the U.S. for military protection, insisting, "We need to be making a profit." When Trump said, "We need to get our money back," Tillerson stood up, turned his back to the president, and addressed the military officers directly. "Every person who has put on a uniform, they don't do it to make a buck, they did it for their country." Trump grew red-faced but didn't engage. As Trump's presidency progressed, a pattern emerged of staff working to contain his worst impulses. When Trump wanted to send a letter to Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Burr with exculpatory news articles, McGahn refused, explaining it would jeopardize judicial confirmations. When Christie entered, Trump asked him instead, but Christie also declined, prioritizing judge confirmations over whatever the fucking letter says. Trump dismissed them both as jokes, prompting McGahn to confide to Christie, "I wish you were around every day, because then I wouldn't be the only dick in the building." John Kelly centralized power in the White House after becoming chief of staff in July 2017. Imposing rigid structures that ran counter to Trump's spontaneity. Kelly restricted access to the president, screened his calls, and pre-vetted papers before they reached Trump's desk. This control irritated Trump, who began calling Kelly the church lady behind his back. Kelly refused to give Ivanka and Kushner special treatment, telling Mattis privately that he thought they were idiots who needed to leave the White House. Despite these tensions, lawmakers like Senator Bob Corker considered Kelly, Mattis, and Tillerson essential guardrails that separate our country from chaos. On September 5, 2018, the New York Times published an unprecedented anonymous op-ed by a senior official describing efforts to contain an impetuous president. The editorial claimed there had been early whispers about invoking the 25th Amendment. alarmed White House aides texted each other that the sleeper cells have awoken. Kelly's credibility, built over decades of military service, was severely damaged by the Rob Porter scandal in February 2018. When allegations of domestic abuse emerged against Porter, the White House staff secretary who controlled the flow of paper to the president, Kelly initially defended him as a man of true integrity and honor. After The Intercept published photos of Porter's ex-wife with a black eye, Kelly issued a second statement claiming shock. At a February 9 meeting, Kelly claimed he had taken action within 40 minutes of learning the allegations were credible, but staffers believed he was blatantly lying. The scandal revealed that Porter had been working with an interim security clearance despite the FBI flagging derogatory information to the White House in July 2017. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders became so frustrated with the misleading information that she confronted Don McGahn in a shouting match heard by a dozen staffers, refusing to speak publicly until provided more information. By March 2018, Robert Mueller's investigation remained completely opaque to Trump's team. While the president aired his thoughts hourly, Mueller maintained strict silence, giving no interviews or public appearances. The White House had provided extensive documentation to Mueller's team under Ty Cobb and John Dowd's strategy of full cooperation. For many Trump aides, Mueller interviews were terrifying experiences, conducted in windowless government buildings with half a dozen prosecutors and FBI agents, sometimes including body language experts observing their responses. The witnesses feared both oversharing and slipping into a lie, knowing either could be disastrous. The Mueller team's questioning was thorough and meticulously prepared, asking the same questions multiple ways to elicit revealing answers. As one witness noted, they don't ask any question they don't know the answer for. On April 9, 2018, FBI agents raided Michael Cohen's hotel room, apartment, and office, seizing phones, computers, and boxes of financial records. The warrant cited potential bank fraud, mail fraud, and campaign finance violations. Cohen's lawyer, Steve Ryan, interrupted during his morning workout, was stunned by the news and immediately contacted prosecutors demanding the return of privileged documents. The raid was extraordinary. Cohen wasn't merely Trump's attorney, but his virtual vault, the keeper of his secrets. As one former U.S. attorney remarked, this search warrant is like dropping a bomb on Trump's front porch. Trump was furious upon learning of the raid, peppering White House lawyer Ty Cobb with questions about its legality and precedent. He wanted to know who authorized it, suspecting Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Trump's personal lawyers canceled their scheduled meeting with Mueller that day, convinced the Cohen investigation was a backdoor way to pressure Cohen to reveal private conversations with the president. On August 21, Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to 8 felony counts in Manhattan, testifying that he made hush money payments in coordination and at the direction of Trump. Simultaneously, a Virginia jury found Paul Manafort guilty of 8 counts, including tax fraud, bank fraud, and failure to disclose foreign bank accounts. As these legal blows landed, Trump was en route to a West Virginia rally where he denounced the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt. On March 22, 2019, Mueller delivered his completed 448-page report to the Justice Department. Ed O'Callaghan, Bill Barr, Rod Rosenstein, and Brian Rabbit immediately began reviewing it, surprised that Mueller's team hadn't redacted sensitive grand jury material as they had expected. The 448-page report was a detailed catalog of presidential misconduct, with Volume 2 examining 10 potential obstruction of justice episodes. It revealed a presidency consumed by paranoia, with Trump pressuring aides to lie and create false records. Inside Mueller's office, prosecutors had vigorously debated how to articulate their findings on obstruction, particularly given the Office of Legal Counsel opinion prohibiting charging a sitting president. Some prosecutors believed they had substantial evidence meeting prosecution requirements, while others felt they lacked hard proof of Trump's intent. The debate centered on how clearly to communicate the gravity of Trump's actions to Congress and the public. Barr, Rosenstein, and O'Callaghan reviewed the report over the weekend, finding the evidence truly disturbing, but concluding they couldn't prove corrupt intent. They struggled to find quotable material in what they considered a garbled mess. O'Callaghan suggested including Mueller's line that, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. When Mueller's team declined to review Barr's draft summary, they missed a crucial opportunity to shape the public narrative. When Barr's four-page letter was released declaring no collusion and insufficient evidence of obstruction, euphoria swept through Trump's camp. The president declared complete and total exoneration, despite Barr's letter explicitly stating otherwise. Mueller's team was livid at Barr's characterization of their work. In a formal letter on March 27, Mueller objected that Barr's summary did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of their investigation, warning this threatens to undermine essential purpose of appointing a special counsel. On April 18, Barr released the report with a press conference, emphasizing no collusion and offering sympathetic explanations for Trump's potentially obstructive acts. Democrats and former prosecutors denounced Barr as partisan, but Trump was thrilled, telling Christie, "I love this guy. He's a warrior." Despite over 1,000 former federal prosecutors signing a letter stating Trump's conduct would normally result in multiple felony charges, Democrats failed to generate sufficient momentum for impeachment, while the White House blocked requests for records and testimony. Mueller ultimately fumbled his moment by refusing to answer questions about his findings until his July testimony and by producing a 448-page report that few would fully absorb. His silence allowed Trump and Barr to control the narrative. As former FBI colleague Frank Figliuzzi observed, Mueller ended up getting played by being too invested in institutional norms under assault. Though history might eventually vindicate his approach to restoring faith in institutions. On July 25, 2019, believing himself invincible after Mueller's inconclusive congressional testimony, Trump called Ukrainian President Zelensky and asked for a favor to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. This brazen attempt to leverage military aid for political dirt triggered a whistleblower complaint and formal impeachment inquiry. The episode revealed how Trump, now free from restraining advisors, had grown increasingly unbound by norms or laws. By October, his impulsive withdrawal of troops from Syria abandoned Kurdish allies and created regional chaos, prompting bipartisan horror. Former officials observed a fundamental shift. The presidency of one had replaced the earlier ethos of advisors trying to educate and moderate Trump. His solipsism and obsession with personal benefit over national interest threatened to become his undoing. On June 18, 2019, in sweltering Orlando, Trump officially launched his re-election campaign before 20,000 rapturous supporters. Televangelist Paula White opened with a prayer declaring Trump would overcome every strategy from hell. Trump's followers embraced his narrative completely. Democrats were liars, the Russia investigation a witch hunt, and Mueller's conclusion a total exoneration. Trump framed the 2020 election as a referendum on investigators' un-American conduct and declared himself victorious over the greatest witch hunt in political history, still refusing to accept Russian interference despite his own intelligence agency's conclusions. The book leaves readers with a disturbing portrait of a presidency where traditional guardrails had fallen away. What began as an administration with experienced advisors attempting to channel Trump's impulses into coherent policy had evolved into a government serving primarily the president's personal interests and grievances. As one official observed, there was more of an ethos in the place earlier that prevented such behavior. The question remaining was whether America's democratic institutions could withstand the unprecedented strain of a president who viewed himself as above the law and the nation as an extension of his personal brand.